It's 88.5 KCSN, Nick Harcourt with you on the morning show. And last weekend, actually, when we were on the first day of our pledge drive, Katie Tunstall was in town and actually had a couple of nights at the Masonic Lodge there over where all the dead people are. And dead famous people. And came in to record a session for us. So first of all, welcome.
Thank you so much.
I know that you're going to play a couple of songs for us, and we're going to talk about the new album, Invisible Empire, Crescent Moon. But why don't we hear the music first, and then we'll come back and catch up.
Sure thing.
Thanks for coming all the way to the valley for us.
I love it. I love this place.
Good.
I'm going to bust in with track one. It's always a good place to start. The candle was gonna go out. The wind was blowing and the door was open, but the candle never went out, never went out. The wave found its way to the shore. I thought it was a ripple and nothing more, but the wave found its way all the way to the shore. Oh, I want to burn this house. I know I want to jump into the fire. Whoa, I've got to tear them down, the pinnacle of my invisible empire. Another gamble never works twice. All the distractions at the table and weighted dice, but the thrill of it feels so nice. You do it all again. But I look to the chips I lose. I'm standing on a platform with my neck in the noose, and I know it's not my time, not my time. Whoa, I wanna burn this house. I know I wanna jump in the fire. Whoa, I've gotta tear them down, the pinnacles of my invisible empire. And if I do all the things I do while I tell myself that I'm staying true, I'll never stop, you know, I'll never stop, you know, I'll never think about it. Put an end to all this time I would spend with it on my mind. It never stopped, you know, it never stopped. No, I always wondered about it. I wondered about the wonder. Whoa, 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 I wear a resting crown. I know this dynasty is falling. The crowd shout for another round to see the ruin, the spectacular diamonds bearing icebergs, the minarets and the marketplaces, the signal fires of my invisible empire.
Covered in cold,
shouted him down. My heart is on a wire, sitting pretty like a bird. But the hunter is out, and the eagle has heard the word that I feel, feel, oh. Yes, I can feel. To the sky, and I'll be listening to the stars, and maybe thinking of you, and wondering where you are. And do you know what you've done for me? You made my branches grow. Now they can play with the wind, and they can carry the snow. They can feel, feel it all.
Very lovely. It's 88.5 KCSN. Katie Tunstall in studio. And I should point out that the tambourine that you were playing while you were playing guitar as well, brilliant, is on the floor. And
yeah, my tambourine bone's connected to my guitar bone.
It's very heavily padded because you basically stomp on it with those shoes that I believe have steel toe caps on them.
They do have little metal deals on the front of them, so it's like
kick the crap out of anybody who gets out of hand.
If anyone's giving me any hassle at gigs, you know, just a little flick of the toe.
Look, I don't want to be racist or anything, but I can tell you're Scottish.
How dare you?
How dare you?
Who do you think you are?
Toe cap boots. Welcome to KCSN. It's good to see you.
It's lovely to be here.
I was surprised actually this morning when I came in, and I knew you were going to be in the station today, but I didn't realize that I was going to be interviewing you. So it was a lovely surprise because you and I just talked a month ago or something.
I know. You're like the staple LA experience.
Well, you
for
don't
me.
See me for 5 years.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden we see each other, and it's funny because I've only ever met you like half a dozen times, but whenever you show up, it just feels so easy to talk to
Absolutely.
You. Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about the new album. And obviously, you know, I'm going to ask you the same questions that you hear over and over again, but give different answers.
I'm going to give you, like Bob Dylan, I'm just going to give you completely, I'm just going to feed you lies.
Inaudible, unintelligible. responses. Thank you.
I'm just going to respond with numbers.
You know what? I've got a desire to interview Bob Dylan one day. Really.
How would you go about that?
I don't know, but I think that I could get him to speak and be understandable.
It would be like Frost Nixon.
It'd be
hardcore, right? Dylan.
I like where you're going. Okay, new album, Invisible Empire /.
Yeah.
Crescent.
The guitarist /
Crescent Moon. Crescent obviously, Moon. He was a guest on the album. The album was made in two different halves, which is an unusual way of doing things. And I guess where we should start is talk about how you first started the process of making this album. Fourth album, I believe, right?
It is, yeah.
And you went to the desert.
I did. I went to Arizona.
With Hal Gelb. First of all, yeah. How did that come about?
Well, I am friends with a really great British musician called Robin Hitchcock.
I know Robin.
And Robin...
Very tall fellow.
Yeah, very tall fellow. And he... He gets set these missions by different art groups in the UK and kind of, you know, music boards. And he's just a go-to guy for putting stuff together, for curating weird stuff. Mm-hmm. And he got asked to put this tour together, and he called it the Floating Palace. And he got six artists to all go on tour together and basically be each other's band for a couple of songs each. It was a great idea. And it was myself and Hal Gelb and Robin himself, Martin and Eliza Carthy, who are total folk legends in the UK, and a US singer called Crystal Warren. And we had such a good time, and Hal and I were just this totally unlikely pairing. We just completely hit it off. And he's, you know, Giant Sand are like a punk band played at the slow speed on your record player. They're just this fantastic, free-spirited, experimental rock band. And he's a real underdog. And he likes it that way, and he's kept under the fringes, and I very much haven't. So it was a meeting of two worlds completely. And I think he recognized that I wanted to do things differently and record in a freer and more experimental way. And I think he was interested to work with someone who was from the world of major labels and pop. You know?
Well, obviously, because you've been very fortunate that you've had a lot of success in your career, and obviously a lot of people know who you are. Hits will do that, obviously.
Yeah, it's a weird skeleton key when it happens. You know, it's just stuff that you were never heading for, and suddenly it opens up some very bizarre doors for you.
I'm sure strange yeah. ones and good yeah. ones and not so good ones. But
yeah, exactly.
So you end up in the desert with him. You guys decided to work together. Now tell us about that time first of all, because you got the first half of the album from those sessions.
It was a very interesting process for me, because part of working with Hal and part of the draw to work with Hal was really getting rid of labeling what we were doing. So he said, come out to Tucson and record. Just come record and have some fun. So there was no, I'm going out to work with Hal Gelb to make an album. I wasn't even planning on making an album.
You were just like, we're going to hang out and see
what I was going to take some time off and just chill. And yeah, and it was just such an interesting invitation. And we met in February during the tour, and I decided to go out at the end of April. And I didn't have any material. But because I got sparked by going on this trip, I wrote about 9 songs in a couple of months, which is a lot for me. I wouldn't usually write that much. And I certainly wouldn't write stuff all at once. I usually start and finish a song and then move on to the next one. And this one was like the kind of lever game at an old school fairground where you've got all the horses going at once. And I was going, I'm never going to finish anything. I've just got all this stuff that I've started. And then they all came in about the same time, just before I went out there. So I actually had basically the first half of a record.
Now where were you at this time up here in your head mentally when you wrote these songs? Because as we mentioned, and we'll talk about why, but the first batch of songs are very different from the second batch of songs. How would you describe that first grouping?
The first grouping, hindsight isn't a wonderful thing. You can judge with very different eyes. And I had such a seismic shifting summer. It was such a traumatic and very difficult summer that followed that session. And I suppose that, and Hal and I spoke about this, that the subconscious is often much more aware of your situation than your present brain is. And so the first batch of songs were very brooding, very questioning, there's the subject of mortality in there and questioning decisions and the life that you've made for yourself. And so there's a brooding feel, melancholic feel to the first half.
And if I can interrupt, obviously you're getting to the point that when you were writing these songs,
I'm on your couch and you're getting out of me.
as you look back at them afterwards, you could see that you were almost foretelling in your songs. Your subconscious was telling you something that was coming. And when you say they're brooding, that
There's often a weird voodoo to songwriting where you don't know what you're writing about, and you write a song and you like it, but you're like, I don't actually know what this means.
Don't really know what that means. But then a couple of months later.
Yeah. And also it can happen over a longer period of time that you write a song that is so perfect for your situation 3 or 4 years later. You're like, I can't believe I didn't write that now.
Right.
I wrote it then. But it's, you know, informing life.
You did the first batch of songs and then you took a break because you weren't really sure what was going on.
Well, and actually also from a practical point of view, it's exceptionally dangerous for a Scottish person to be in Arizona during the summer months.
Well, because you're so white.
Insane. Yeah. I'm see-through. I can't be there.
You're blue.
It was getting crazy by the time I left in May.
So you took a break and then a whole bunch of seismic shifts happened in your life.
Yeah, so I lost my father in August, and he had been sick, and that had been part of the kind of the mood that I had been in, but he certainly wasn't. It was still a shock that he died when he did. And I was okay with it. It was, you know, he was ill. He was an old man, and nature was at work. That's the way around it should be, you know. The old guy goes first, but it's always difficult. But that in itself produced huge changes in me. There was no notion within me of how that was going to affect me, and it really changed me quite deeply when my dad went. And there had been unhappiness in my life, and doing this is a crazy job. It's a very strange thing to happen to a person, to go from zero to hero and realize your dream, and then what next?
And then
you know?
Wonder what it's all about.
Yeah, and so and sadly, my marriage ended in the summer as well. And I'd been with, he was the drummer in my band. We'd been together for 10 years, married for 5, and so it was, my life was completely different by the time I went back to Arizona to finish this off.
A lot of loss, obviously. And interestingly enough, I remember when the first time, I'm sorry to say this to you, but I remember the first time I met you, I think you'd just gotten with your guy and you were very, very happy and writing happy songs.
Yeah.
Well, you know, things change. Yeah. And
sad songs, unfortunately, are always better.
so by the time you got back to Arizona, tell us about the second group of songs, because as we said, the album really is two, it's almost like two sort of half albums.
Yeah. And I mean, I'd be interested to know if someone listening to the record who didn't know about this would recognize the split. I must try that on someone from a jungle tribe.
Someone from Mars or something.
The second half is very different. So by the time I went back, it was November. The dust had settled somewhat, but most of all, I was just really excited about getting out of Dodge. I was just really happy to leave London and go back to Arizona, where music is always an escape. It's always a route out. You can get lost in it, and so it was quite cathartic to just get back into music again, and it felt very liberating. And so weirdly, the second half, after everything's happened, felt very hopeful and very widescreen, and the music became more cinematic and less formulated. I left the kind of old school traditional songwriting form that I've always employed and started being a bit more Haug Elb about it.
Well, tell us what that means.
No rules. There's just no rules. And particularly on Crescent Moon, which was why I was so happy to have that as the first track of the second half, as the second title track, was because it just literally came out of my hands onto the piano as soon as I arrived. And I just sang it like I was remembering something. It was a very unanalytical, very compulsive song. And for the first time, I felt like I was really, really properly using instrumentation lyrically. I was using arrangement and instruments and melody to communicate on a level, which I've always tried to do in terms of the music being emotive. But this was more of a kind of orchestral feel where it was actually communicating through melody with no lyric. And so the lyrics didn't have to be there all the time.
I do say this to people when they mention no rules. As you know, I talk to a lot of people in my job. And I interviewed Peter Frampton a few years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And he was the guy who told me there's no rules in music.
Yeah.
People think there are because that's how you're taught.
Yeah.
But he said there really aren't any rules in music.
It's frighteningly easy to impose them upon yourself and not even realize that you've done it.
So, you know, you're going to finish up and play one more song for us before we wrap it up. But where are you at right now that you've sort of had this cathartic experience of loss and, I guess, you know, growth, redemption,
for sure. There's
rebuilding.
Huge amount of positivity.
And out and about playing these songs.
I have a completely different relationship to what I do now. So music has ceased to be the be-all and end-all, which it was. And that's very freeing to kind of not care so much.
Is that because you realize your life is about more?
Life is about life, and music is part of life.
Sure.
And before, life was music. And I still really enjoy it. I still really love it. And I still plan to make more. But it's, there's been a massive shift in my relationship with it. And also using it in terms of gaining approval, feeling good about myself. You know, it doesn't mean the same thing to me what people think of what I'm doing. And funnily enough, this is the first time I've not read any press about a record that I've done. And I met Moby a few years ago and he told me, you know, I've not read press on my stuff for ages because it just makes me completely depressed.
Sure.
Even if it's good, it's opinionated.
Yeah.
And this time around, I thought, no, this is the time to do it. I'm really proud of what I've done and I don't need to be confused by other people's public judgment of what I'm doing. And then totally typically, like 90% of it's really good. But I'm still not reading it.
Well, you know, because the thing is that, you know, most artists are sensitive on some level or other because that's why you do it. And, you know, you'll get 100 reviews and the one that's crap will, you know, turn you suicidal.
Yeah, terrible.
Good move.
Our poor egos.
But also, I would think that this has something to do with, you know, getting, you know, a little bit older and a little more experience and a little wisdom because, as you said, you know, like, you know, life happens and you sort of have to roll with it.
Yeah,
really.
and it's 10 years next year since that first record came out, and I've basically been touring records all that time, and it was really great to think there's other stuff I want to do. And actually Jim Abbas, who produced Tiger Suit, my third record, him and I over 2 years, because it was quite an electronic record, that one, we kind of vowed to get back in the studio together and just do a side project, electronica side project.
Cool.
and we did, and it basically turned into what has become a feature-length animated movie script with an electronic soundtrack.
And that's coming up next.
And so that's what we've just started speaking to people about, seeing Fantastic. What we can do with that. And it's really exciting for me to maybe move into different areas and try some different stuff.
Well, I really appreciate you coming to KCSN.
Always a pleasure.
And the album is Invisible Empire Crescent Moon. And it's really good, so you should go get it or download it. Don't steal it. And you're gonna wrap up with one more song for us. What are you gonna finish with?
I'm gonna finish up with a song called Made of Glass. And Andrew Bird was coming through town when we recorded this, and we grabbed him.
Did he whistle on it?
And he whistled. My God, like theremin in his thorax. Totally
theremin in his thorax.
Crazy.
I like that.
And so now I am charged with the responsibility.
You have to do the whistling.
Of trying
as well.
To emulate Andrew Bird's whistling, which is no mean feat, I can tell you.
All right, Katie Tunstall wrapping up our program this morning. It is Nick Harcourt Show at 88.5 KCSN. Thanks.
Till I go hard enough to deal with losing. tired of thinking of you. Each and every minute I see something I know that you would love. We're all made of glass, all made of glass, cheating. And love.